our docket's going to be case number 66772, Rebecca versus Nelson. We have three counsel arguing this matter. Just need some ground rules on this. Who will argue first, who will argue second, and who will argue third?
I assume that the appellate trust is going to be arguing first because it's the appellate case.
Okay. And will you be reserving any time?
2 minutes, Your Honor.
And I guess between the two of us, I know I responded to her appellate, her issues on appeal. I don't know if that makes sense.
Would it be the first or if I go?
Would you like to go second?
I'm fine going second.
Either way, fine.
Okay, you'll go second and you'll go third. And then if you saved any time, you'll get to use that time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Right.
The only person who can save time is your initial appellate trust.
Right, yeah, I think that's the way to do it. And if each of you will be real specific as to who you represent and what issues you're bringing forth to us, so.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This will be a 45-minute argument.
May it please the court, my name is Jeff Luchek and I represent Matt Klebaka, the distribution trustee of the ELN Trust. The ELN Trust requests that this court reverse portions of the 8 orders on appeal and reassign this matter to the probate court for a new trial on the merits. As an initial matter, the district court lacked jurisdiction to hear the trust matters arising out of Title 13. Pursuant to NRS 163.115, a proceeding for a breach of trust or to impose a constructive trust must be commenced pursuant to NRS 164.015. NRS 164.015 provides the probate court exclusive jurisdiction over matters regarding the internal affairs and administration of a trust.
Well, let me ask you this. The probate judge is designated by the chief judge of the district court, and who can designate any judge to handle probate matters. Under our case law, family court judges are considered having the same right to do activities that civil criminal judges do. Plus, on top of that, they can do family law matters. So why couldn't the chief judge, I think, could have assigned a family court judge to deal with probate issues if the chief judge so desired to do so?
Where, under the current rule, that's correct. Under 4.02, which was approved in September of 2014, that is the correct under today's law. However, in 2011 and 2012, EDCR 4.6A applied. And under that rule, all matters initiated under Titles 12 and 13 were assigned to the probate judge. The probate judge didn't want to hear the matter, could assign it to any other judge in the district except for a judge sitting in the family division.
Wouldn't the court's decision in Landreth versus Malik override that local rule there?
Well, I don't think so, for two reasons. One, I don't think Landreth allowed or granted the family court the ability to ignore NRS 164.015, which granted the probate court exclusive jurisdiction over probate matters. Two, with EDCR, it was this court that ruled that the family court did not have the ability to hear matters arising out of probate and specifically set forth the procedures in which that needed to occur, which was it would go to the probate judge. Now, one of the reasons why it's important that it went to the probate judge as opposed to being heard by the family court is because the family court isn't familiar with Title 13 and the procedures associated with Title 13. So as a result of that, what happened was is the other beneficiaries of the ELN and LSN trust weren't provided notice as required by 164.037. Therefore, they didn't have the opportunity to make an appearance and participate in the case. In addition to the jurisdiction issue, I guess just moving on to the errors of law, unless you have any more questions with respect to
that. No, that's fine. You've answered it. Thank you.
The district court also erred by ordering the ELN Trust to pay the personal obligations of Eric Nelson in the amount of $1,068,000 for alimony, child support, attorney's fees, and special master fees.
Now, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, counsel, to clarify that these trusts were formed, they were spendthrift irrevocable trusts, and the parties signed agreement implementing these trusts in that category, and that Mrs. Nelson had independent counsel advise her on whether or not to enter into that agreement. So am I correct on the factual?
Yeah, that is correct. There's really a series of trusts. In 1993, the parties entered into a separate property agreement, and they also entered into separate property trusts at that time in 1993. In 2000, and at that time, she was represented by Richard Koch, but she was also explained about the benefits about that by Jeffrey Berg. In 2001, Eric and Lenita created self-settled spendthrift trust pursuant to 166.020, and she was also represented by counsel at that point, and all of the legal ramifications of that were explained to her at that time as well.
Okay, thank you.
Pursuant to NRS 166.120, payments made by a trustee to a beneficiary of a spendthrift trust must be for the benefit of the beneficiary and not pursuant to legal process like execution, judgment, attachment, or garnishment. Opposing counsel conceded that there was no creditor exception for alimony and child support when he sought to amend NRS 166 in 2013. However, the amendment never passed. Notwithstanding this concession, the district court erred by ordering the ELN Trust to pay alimony and child support from the ELN Trust in relying upon statutes from South Dakota and Wyoming, albeit those statutes specifically create a creditor exception. Moving on to the next error, the district court erred by equalizing the trusts, the ELN Trust and the LSN Trust, which were the self-settled spendthrift trust, for three separate reasons. First, neither Eric nor Lenita had a community or separate property interest in the ELN or the LSN Trust. Pursuant to NRS 166.130, Eric and Lenita do not possess a legal estate in the trust assets, but rather possess a discretionary interest as defined in NRS 163.4185, subject to the approval of the distribution trustee. The second reason why the district court erred in equalizing the trusts is because it relied upon inadmissible parole evidence that Eric and Lenita intended to equalize the trusts via future gifts, despite the fact that there was no legally enforceable gift to do so. Here are the terms of the ELN and the LSN trust that are clear and unambiguous. There is no requirement for either the ELN trust or the LSN trust to make future gifts to equalize the trust. This was conceded by the district court in the divorce decree when it cited the testimony from Jeffrey Burr, who said that he had discussed and suggested that Eric and Lenita periodically transfer properties to equalize the trusts. He even provided a form for them to do so. However, Jeffrey Burr made it clear that any equalization was at the sole discretion of the ELN or the LSN trust. So, for example, if the ELN trust wanted to equalize the trust, equalize its assets with the LSN trust, it had to make a gift to the LSN trust, and vice versa. Because there was no legally forcible agreement, the district court erred by enforcing the purported intent of the parties as opposed to following the clear and unambiguous terms of the trust.
Let me ask you, was there any argument made that either one of these people were fraudulently induced to enter into the trust in the first place, or was this simply an argument was made, this parole evidence came up after the fact here? How was this presented to the district court?
With respect to the intent, I think what happened was is the district court just looked at the testimony of Jeffrey Burr and took the position that since Jeffrey Burr said that the parties could equalize the trust if they deemed fit.
But the parties didn't argue to the district court they were fraudulently induced to entering into these trusts.
My recollection is Lenita did take the position that she was led to believe that the trust would not apply in the event of a divorce. But I don't believe she took the position that she was fraudulently induced with respect to entering the agreement as a whole.
Okay, thank you.
The third reason why the district court erred by equalizing the trusts is because it enforced the trust for creditor protection purposes but not divorce, because it did not believe that Eric and Lenita intended the estate plan to control in the event of divorce. The district court's position, however, is contrary to both case law and the facts of the matter. Cited two cases, the marriage of Holtman and the estate of Lund, which are both California cases. In those cases, the husband transmutated separate property to community property for the sole purposes of estate planning. In the estate planning executed by the husband and wife, it was made clear that if divorce was initiated, the transmutation from separate to proper community property was null and void, and it would revert back to separate property. In both cases, the California Appellate Court rejected the notion that a husband and wife can conditionally transfer assets for estate planning purposes and not in the event of divorce. And here, unlike the documents in Holtman and Lund, the trusts do not contain conditional application. Notwithstanding, the district court ignored the clear terms of the documents and relied upon Lenita's inadmissible testimony that she did not believe it would apply in the event of divorce. Lenita's testimony, however, was rebutted by the testimony of Jeffrey Burr and Richard Koch. Jeffrey Burr testified that he explained the detriments and the benefits of the separate property agreement to Eric and Lenita, one of which was divorce. Jeffrey Burr also testified that they bore the risk that their spouse could stand by the terms of the separate property agreement in the event of divorce and could not have, and they wouldn't have an interest in the other spouse's separate property, including if Eric and Lena were divorced the next day. Similarly, Richard Koch, who represented Lenita with respect to the separate property agreement, the separate property trust that was created in 1993, testified that it was his custom and practice to explain the differences between community and separate property and the legal effect of, of that division. He also executed a certification saying that he fulfilled his legal and ethical obligations, and Lenita acknowledged that understanding in writing and verbally. In addition to the testimony by Jeffrey Burr and Richard Koch that Lenita understood the documents that she had entered into, her actions confirmed that she understood the legal ramifications of a separate property agreement and the subsequent trusts. First, she executed the trust documents themselves, which confirmed her acknowledgement of assent. Second, in February of 2009, she amended her separate property trust to disinherit Eric as a beneficiary. She had truly believed that those documents did not apply, she would have never amended those documents in the first place. Now, even if the district court did not err in equalizing the trust was appropriate and the district court did not commit error by doing so, it erred in the application of the equalization. To begin with, the district court ordered the ELN trust to transfer $5 million worth of assets to the LSN trust so that each trust would hold approximately $8.7 million in assets. However, it was never a true equalization because at that time, the ELN trust assets were actually only worth $7.85 million and the LSN trust assets were worth $8.7 million. Then, after this purported equalization, the district court kept chipping away at the assets owned by the ELN trust. For example, the $1,086,000 that the district court ordered the ELN trust to pay for Eric's personal obligations. The district court also ordered the ELN trust to pay $75,000 that was a loan that was made in 2011. The district court also ordered the ELN trust to pay rents that it collected from May of 2009 to June of 2013 through the Ellison Trust. So assuming that the district court doesn't order the ELN Trust to make any more payments, the ELN Trust has approximately $6.44 million and the LSN Trust has over $10 million. So this $3.6 million disparity has thwarted the district court's stated intent to equalize the trusts. What makes the district court's ruling with respect to the rent collected from May 2009 to June 2013 even more egregious is the fact that Lenita had actually filed a claim for the rents that had been collected by the trust. And there is evidence presented at trial regarding the rents collected, and the district court equalized the trust based upon such evidence. The district court in the decree also confirmed that it had disposed of all the issues except for one parcel of property, Wyoming Downs. Notwithstanding, after the district court was divested of jurisdiction, after the first appeal was filed, it ordered the ELN Trust to pay additional tens of thousands of dollars to the LSN Trust. In addition to the equalization favoring the LSN Trust, the district court also completely disregarded the millions of dollars of liabilities that were identified by Larry Birch and Dan Garrity. For example, there was promissory notes. that were admitted as evidence in trial. One for $200,000, one for $105,000. District Court completely disregarded it. There was a line of credit that the ELN Trust had taken out in the amount of $1.1 million, which once again was disregarded by the court. Then there was millions of dollars of additional contingent liabilities that the District Court completely disregarded. In so doing, the District Court erred by ignoring the liabilities because it should have provided the ELN Trust credit for the liabilities, or at the very least, that the ELN was liable for 50%. The District Court also erred by imposing a constructive trust over ELN Trust property, specifically with respect to Russell Road. There was no conflicting evidence at trial with respect to Russell Road. Lomita had purchased 3.3 acres of property off Russell Road property in Las Vegas in 1999. She subsequently transferred that acreage to obtain a 50% interest in a partnership named CGE&L. CGE&L was supposed to build a boat store on the Russell Road property. In 2004, Lanita executed a guarantee for a flooring contract, which she subsequently withdrew in 2015. In so doing, she relinquished her interest in CGE&L. There was no evidence at trial that Eric had anything to do with that. The relinquishment of that interest in CG&L. After she relinquished her interest, CG&L obtained another 6 acres of property, thereby increasing the acreage to $9 million. And in February of 2010, the ELN Trust spent $4 million to obtain a 66% interest in CG&L. At trial, the District Court valued the ELN Trust interest in Russell Road at $45 million. And imposed a $2.25 million constructive trust in favor of the LSN Trust, based upon its unsubstantiated belief that the LSN Trust had relinquished its interest due to the advice and direction of Eric, which once again, there was no evidence with respect to that. Even if there was substantial evidence to support this theory, however, the District Court erred because it awarded the LSN Trust $2.25 million, although its initial investment was only $855,000. Two, the acreage owned by CGE&L in 2010 is three times larger than when Lomita had an interest in 2005. And three, the District Court failed to credit the $4 million that was paid by the ELN Trust.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Joseph Caraccioni on behalf of Lomita Nelson. There is one issue in this appeal that permeates over all the other issues briefed and being discussed, and which has tremendous consequences for married people of this state. Whether a spouse can defeat the property rights of another spouse by convincing him or her to transfer property without an understanding of the legal effects of such transfers and while representing that such transfers are for the benefit of the community.
Now wait, do you dispute then that there wasn't individual representation for Lanita,
yes.
under both provisions, under the separate property trust and the spendthrift trust?
There absolutely was not independent representation for Lanita when the 2001 spendthrift trust were entered into. In fact,
Mr. Koch, that was a misrepresentation that Mr. Koch didn't participate?
Mr. Koch participated in 1993. Mr. Burr was very clear, and that's what's very frustrating about this case. You have a 50-page decree of divorce. This is not like the recent cases the court has seen where this court needs to guess what the district court was thinking. There's a 50-page decree of divorce. There's only been three challenges to the facts stated in that 50 pages. In that 50 pages, the court specifically set forth and found unchallenged factual findings that she relied on her husband and her attorney, Jeffrey Burr, as her representative. And she went along with
that could be said in any of these cases that involves very particular trusts. There's many benefits and there's certainly detriments. And why couldn't that be the case in every single one of these cases that's challenged?
Because in this case, she was specifically led to believe that this estate planning by her attorney, Mr. Burr, and by her husband would not apply in the event of divorce. The testimony was very clear on this issue, and I can quote by Jeffrey Burr. When my opponent says that she was represented by independent counsel in 2001 for the trust, that's not true. They both went to see Mr. Burr. And Jeffrey Burr made it clear during the trial the dynamics between this family and what the advice was. He said, and this is quote, well, keep in mind that the dynamics between Lenita and Eric was pretty much the business guy, and so he was the one I would predominantly communicate. Another answer, I've got to say again, in fairness, Lenita, because she wasn't involved in the business, and she struggled to understand totally, you know, all the intricacies of what was going on, the technicalities, but, you know, she trusted Eric pretty much to make those kinds of decisions. And so together we had a discussion, but she pretty well admitted, look, I think this is kind of Greek to me, you know, but if you say it's a good thing to do and we'll move forward, that's my best recollection. Then what happens? Mr. Burr said, tells the court, testifies that he told them that this isn't something you should rely upon in the event of divorce. And these are quotes from Mr. Burr, and these are the findings that the court made. And this testimony was elicited by the husband during his case in chief in 2010. And during that time, he testified to the court that not only did he elicit the testimony of Mr. Burr, but he himself testified. This was all community property. I moved property back and forth between trusts in order to maintain balance and to do it for my business purposes. I managed everything. I managed it for the benefit of our community. I managed it for the benefit of Lenita and our children. And this is what the district court found that this gentleman told, the husband in this case, Eric Nelson, told his wife, is that she trusted him. She went along. He handled all the business aspects. Well, she trusted her husband and followed. She was a stay-at-home mother to 5 children. And that's what's incredibly important in this case. And I think, from a legal perspective, that my opponent said it best when he said, or when they said in their factual statement, albeit under this alternate set of facts that isn't consistent with what the district court found and which hasn't been challenged on appeal, both Eric and Lenita knew that by dividing their community property in separate property, it would become separate for all purposes, and there could not be a wink and nod side agreement that the separate property agreement would not apply in the case of divorce, because if such a side agreement existed, it would render the separate property agreement invalid or ineffective. Burr confirmed that in order for this plan to be effective, the parties had to reach an agreement dividing the community assets for all purposes without any side agreements, e.g., it would be valid as to creditors but not in the event of divorce. Simply put, the parties could not, on one hand, agree to treat the property as separate for creditor purposes, while on the other hand, have a side agreement that would not be treated as separate property in any other instance, including divorce. But that's exactly what Lenita was being told by Mr. Burr, is that this is just for asset protection purposes. This is what you do to protect your assets. You can't depend on this. The testimony is abundantly clear on that, and that's why in the briefs, in the reply brief, and in the opening brief, we've extensively quoted direct quotes from the testimony in this case.
And for one purpose, you will get the benefit of having this transmutation in the separate property trust. But for another instance, I didn't understand.
In order, though, for a trust to be created, one has to actually have an intent to create a trust and actually to transfer property. From the beginning, these trusts are never valid. They never intended to relinquish the ownership interest. And again, you're dealing with a woman who's a stay-at-home mother who, like so many other spouses in this state, trusts their spouse to do what's best for them. And remember, we look at these cases with a heightened level of scrutiny because there's a confidential relationship between them. And so the court looks at those, any kind of decisions made by them and contracts entered into in the case law and under 123, subject to the fact that there's a fiduciary relationship between them. And it was because of that fiduciary relationship that he was able to induce her into going along with this plan. And for 4-6 days in trial, he stood there and said, this is all ours, this is our community property. And only when he didn't like the way that it was going did he change positions mid-trial. At the time that he testified, he's the investment trustee of the trust. He's the only person who can bind the trust in litigation. This isn't like cases where we've had, where the court, like in Gladys Baker and the Guerin v. Guerin case, where the court said, oh, you didn't join the trust, so these proceedings are invalid. Actually, the trustee, the only person in this case, not a third party, the only person who can act on behalf of the trust is sitting there testifying to the court that this is all our community property. To the subject matter jurisdiction point, that issue was decided in Landreth versus Malik. And 164.015, the legislature specifically says in 164.0401, NRS 164.0410 and 015 do not limit or abridge the power or jurisdiction of the district court over trust and trustees. A court is defined in 015 as a court, or in 132.116, excuse me, as a district court of the state sitting in probate or otherwise adjudicating matters pursuant to this title. This court already answered the question about subject matter jurisdiction. They try to make a distinction between the power to adjudicate cases and subject matter jurisdiction, but in Landreth, this court said that the power to adjudicate cases and the subject matter jurisdiction of the district court are both found in Article 6, Section 6 of the Nevada Constitution.
Do you believe that case trumps any judicial district court rule to the contrary?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that was an excellent point that at that time, the chief judge under the old set of the rule was the one who was assigned the probate calendar and could delegate it. But at one point, that was Judge Ritchie. So if you said that Judge Ritchie didn't have that power, I mean, how many void orders do we have over 2 years? This court already decided that issue. The testimony and evidence presented and the findings of the district court conclusively established that the trust were not valid trusts. The court stated it numerous times, including two times in the decree, two paragraphs, that it could have invalidated it. That, as I previously stated, a trust requires a valid restraint on the transfer of property. It has to be created by a transfer. A trust is created only if the settlor properly manifests an intention, and that didn't happen in this case.
But the trusts were created, they were signed, the assets were transferred into these respective trusts in this separate property agreement in 1993, then they had the self-settled trust in 2001, and divorce didn't start until 2009, so we're talking a long period of time where these trusts existed, did business, and now they're being collaterally attacked here in the divorce proceedings. So, the trusts say what they say, and you're saying, well, that's not what they really meant. But like Justice Perry said, that's problematic for us. You know, we have rules to follow and statutes and all that. How do we deal with that?
Well, first, even if the 1993 agreement's valid with this side agreement to apply to creditors, that doesn't, the rule under the law is that a presumption applies to all property acquired during marriage as community property, and a party can only rebut or overcome that presumption by tracing to a separate property source. They admitted during this case that the 1993 property could not be traced to the property today. In fact, if you look at the district court's decree, the two trusts, the way they were managed, he took millions of dollars of property from her trust. He converted that property from her trust to his trust without compensation. The district court found that in 2004, the ELN Trust only owned one property in Clark County, Nevada. It owned several by the time of the divorce proceeding. Between 2001 and 2009, the husband in this case took, because he was managing her trust as well, even though the argument has been that he didn't, his own testimony was, I manage all the property, took $7 million in assets from her property. If the district court had simply just compensated her for the lost property, not only would she have received half the property, she would have received more than half the property.
Let me ask you this. Let's say, and we don't know what we're going to do, that's why we're having an argument, but let's say we disagree with that. We say the trust of the trust, that's it. Too bad. The judge can't break them, you know, like that. They're irrevocable trust. Doesn't the divorce court have the power to make equitable distribution? Couldn't they order Mr. Nelson, if he committed these torts and all this stuff you're describing, pay so much to Mrs. Nelson without invading the principle of these trusts?
But no, because that would be an order against him individually, and he took the assets from one trust. He's acting on behalf of his trust. He's the investment trustee managing it. He took this $7 million, and this is real property. This is unique. This is special under the law. He took the $7 million, and he put it into his own trust. So the only way for her to recover that same property, for example, Russell Road. Russell Road, there was no consideration paid for Russell Road by the ELN Trust for the initial acquisition that she had. Then she didn't go into business with his brother. CJ E&L was his brother. His brother acquired an interest for a $900,000 property for $20,000 that eventually she relinquished without any proof of any compensation. I mean, even if you uphold the validity of the trust, it would be an extreme injustice in this case for him to be able to keep all of the property that he took from her trust and say, sorry, that's all you have left. He himself testified, again, that he managed, he made all these decisions. It wasn't her making these decisions. She was the stay-at-home wife. And the judge found, the district court judge found specifically, that he would ask her to, he would put documents in front of her. Sometimes he had them notarized back at the office, that there was some that had questionable signatures, and that she trusted him, and that if he didn't get his way, that he would become angry.
Did she ever initiate litigation against him for fraudulent transfers of assets, or anything, or did this just all happen and it was just litigated through the divorce proceedings?
This is how the case began, as a divorce proceeding by husband against wife. For the case proceeded to trial under the assumption that everything was community property. That was husband's position. For six days, he sat there in front of the court and testified that it's all community property. It was only, again, after he didn't like, and this is a specific finding by the district court, where the district court was going, that he said, you know what, we don't really own any of this. And that's the injustice in this case. You have principles like judicial estoppel to protect the integrity of the court, equitable estoppel to prevent, and promissory estoppel to protect somebody who's basically been led to believe one thing, or to protect the integrity of the judiciary when somebody sits there for days on end saying, this is all mine, I managed it, this is all ours, this was for the benefit of the community, and then changes their position. Or tells their spouse for all these years, sign this is for the benefit of us, this is for the benefit of the community. And then after 6 days of trial says, you know what, I don't like how it's going, we don't have an interest in these properties. You also have an extreme lack to follow. Because these trusts were never intended to be valid for all purposes, you have the problem of a lack of formalities. He didn't follow the formalities. And this isn't just minor formalities. Under 11.3 of the trust, Jeff Burr has the sole authority upon 10 days' notice to remove a trustee and to appoint somebody who's an independent under IRC 674. In 2007, he appointed, without the notice, and these are findings of the district court again, he appointed Eric's sister at Eric's direction without the notice. And Eric's sister, as a family member, is not an independent. So now you have, for years, the second time in 2011, he again replaced the trustee. And this time he put a subordinate, who again is not an independent person. And so you have, for a term of years, distributions from a Nevada self-settled spendthrift trust that cannot be made without the independent approval of a distribution trustee, occurring without any properly acting distribution trustee. You also have the trust requires, and these are again findings of the court, unchallenged. May I finish what I said? You have that the trust require a meeting of the majority of trustees prior to any distribution of income, and that they have to discuss with the trustees the advisability, and the distribution trustee must vote in favor of it. And then you have the finding by the court that not only did they not do this and discuss the advisability of distributions, but also they produced meeting minutes that were highly questionable and that said that meetings occurred at Jeffrey Burr's office when the testimony established that no such meetings occurred. So there's no formalities being followed in these trusts.
Let me ask you one question, if I may, Chief.
Sure, go ahead.
This is what I'm trying to get past. Under 122, or 123, Chapter 123, indicates all property other than separate property outlined in 123.130, acquired after marriage as community property, unless otherwise provided by an agreement in writing between the spouses. And when you have a written contract that's clear and unambiguous on its face, why should extraneous evidence be introduced to explain its meaning?
This is a good point. The separate property agreement, if you're referring to a separate property agreement, the separate property agreement makes separate property. Parties can agree, married people can agree to have separate property. Assume that's valid.
And they can agree to take community property and create separate properties?
Yes. Exactly. But now, fast forward 19 years, we have this pile of property. And none of it's the same that's in that agreement. The law provides that the burden is not on you, who's claiming community property. The burden's on the person to show that that property which was acquired during marriage is actually separate property as opposed to community property. It's important because otherwise, you could agree with your spouse at one point in time that let's separate what we have today, and you put it over here, and I'll put it over there. And then you get down the line, you have this whole separate group of property, and the spouse says, it's all mine. Well, why is it mine? Well, because we agreed we had separate property back here. But unless you can trace this new property to that old property, then the presumption is that it's community property. They could not trace it. They called Daniel Garrity as their expert, and it's quoted in the reply brief. They asked him, they said, what was your initial, what were you asked to do? He said, I was asked to trace the property from 1993 to today, and we couldn't do it. And the reason you can't do it is because not only is the property from 1993 to today untraceable, but because you have all these assets commingled that go back and forth between. How do we know that all the properties of the ELN Trust weren't acquired with the $7 million that was taken from her trust? I mean, all of this property could have originated from her property. So we can't just presume that this is is all separate.
I need to cut you off.
Thank you. You answered my question.
Ms. Forsberg or Mr. Nelson?
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Cherry, and Justice of the Court. May it please the Court, I'm Rhonda Forsberg, and I represent Eric Nelson. NRS 125-1550 allows the Court to order alimony that's just and equitable. In this case, the District Court abused its discretion and erred as a matter of law because the party's income has always been derived from these two self-settled spendthrift trusts. And the testimony that occurred in the court actually was Jeffrey Burr explained how he explained to the trustee of the LSN Trust, which is Lenita's trust, how it should be done, what the protocol is for handling distributions. The testimony was that there was at least two meetings with that distribution trustee and that she followed the protocol. The district court actually went through the entire diatribe about how Miss Lenita was being paid monthly from that distribution, her distributions from that LSN trust, exactly as the distribution trustee testified that they were being paid. The district court on page 36 of the decree stated that when determining those historical needs, it went through how she originally received $5,000 a month distribution, then $10,000 a month, and ultimately $20,000 a month. So the district court recognized that she received those. The problem that the district court did is they failed to recognize they actually came from Lenita's own trust, the one that she was a beneficiary of at least. So instead of saying she's receiving the money from her own trust, it said she needs this ultimate $20,000 that the court found was her historical need. However, he failed to recognize none of that money came from Eric Nelson or the ELN trust. So historically, she's always been receiving her needs met by that trust. So the first issue becomes, is it just equitable then to order Eric Nelson to pay alimony when her needs were always met by the very trust that she's a beneficiary of? So that was the first problem. So when you look at the factors of NRS 125-150, one of the factors is the ability of the wife to support herself. He wrote it in the decree how she was getting that money, but he didn't apply it to the fact that he came up with the idea that she needed $20,000. Well, he said she was getting $20,000, but where it was coming from. So the court failed in analyzing that factor whenever it applied the idea of just and equitable. The second issue that the court failed to apply in that issue is that the wife was awarded, as you heard earlier, significant property. We're not talking a tiny bit of property. According to the idea of what Judge Sullivan thought he was doing, is he said he was equalizing him almost to the exact number. It was a little higher in Lenita's to begin with. But as you heard from the attorney for the ELN Trust, distribution trustee, that it turned out not to be that case. It ended up being $10 million and $6 million. So not only did she ended up with severely more property under this idea of equalization, then he inflicted additional salt to the wound by then ordering an alimony award. So that was our first problem on that. But when you look at the specific properties that the court granted her, and when the court talked about how her need was to be met, the court went through an explanation that one property, Lindell, she was going to receive $10,000. And that she'd receive $3,000 from everything else. That's basically what the judge says. I don't know the numbers, so we're just going to arbitrarily assign $3,000. But among those transfers that the judge made, that Judge Sullivan made between the two trusts and his idea that he could equalize such trusts, he transferred, according to the decree, Dan 1 properties, which was 17 properties. He fails to recognize that Dan 1 properties are rental homes in Las Vegas. 17, according to the decree, are rental homes.
Were all these properties you're talking about in these trusts, you know, they were corpuses of the trust?
All the 17 properties were in.
Well, I guess our concern is, how do you order any of this stuff going out of trust? But putting that aside.
That was my thought too, but I still have to address the fact that that's
Well, can I ask you a couple questions? Maybe it'll help us with this. Was there any litigation ever commenced by Mrs. Nelson against Mr. Nelson, alleging that the trusts were fraudulently induced, she was fraudulently induced to enter into the trust and they should be set aside? Did that come up before the divorce at any time?
No, not in that sense, Your Honor. It was, she said, I did it because Eric told me to, and I trusted that he was helping me.
She sued.
She never raised. The only litigation between the parties is a divorce action.
Okay.
That's it.
Second issue, your opposing counsel said that for the beginning of this trial that Mr. Nelson conceded that these trust assets were community property and then shifted gears. What's your position on that?
Well, when I reviewed the entire transcript again, if you looked at his testimony, he never once used the words community property. He said community or community estate, which could also mean the beneficiaries of his trust. He said community, and he's also a layperson. He doesn't, you know, he wouldn't know what the definition of community property is. But I looked through there. The other parties made statements, like the attorney said community property. Mr. Nelson never used that phrase. He said community, community estate. He never used the term community property. So his idea is their community would include their beneficiaries, which are grown children, which are clearly not part of a community property division in a divorce. You don't take into consideration that, but when you're talking about a community and estate planning and in a state sense, you're talking about everybody in that are a beneficiary of those trusts.
Okay, thank you.
Further, the other issue, so looking at those 17 properties that we talked about, they're homes in Las Vegas. Arbitrarily, the court assigned, for what the court showed in there to be 17 homes which were under Ban 1 that transferred from the ELN Trust to the LSN Trust, he assessed $3,000 for all of those plus all the other properties that she had granted. If we just looked at those 17 properties and did simple math, that would be rent on a home of $176 a month. I want that home, because that'd be very reasonable to be able to save for retirement when you have that kind of a rental expense. So the numbers don't make any sense, in addition to the fact that she was receiving that $20,000 from her own trust to begin with. So that's the two issues that I have with the way he ordered alimony, is that he didn't consider the amount of money she was receiving, and how do you arbitrarily come up with $3,000 for what turns out to be $9 million in property a month? I just don't, the math does not work. It's not an investment.
Did he order alimony to come from a specific source, or was it just a general order in the decree to pay alimony?
He ordered ELN Trust to pay the alimony.
Okay.
For
whom? Let's say, depending on how this case goes, wouldn't the court have the discretion to order alimony, maybe not from a trust, but have a personal order to have Mr. Nelson pay alimony? And if Mr. Nelson didn't pay the alimony, I mean, it could be religious, could be reduced to judgment, he could be held in contempt and potentially go to jail. So are there other remedies out there available?
Well, clearly all of those remedies would have been available to the court had they so ordered it like that, Your Honor. However, I think the problem with it is he didn't consider the just and equitable part. The statute is really clear, it has to be just and equitable. You just can't, you know, have this person making tons and tons of money and the other person making a lot of money as well, and both can meet their own needs and say, well, now there's a need to pay because we want to punish one side or the other. That's how it almost feels like. First, you took away the property from the ELN Trust that he's a beneficiary of. Then, in addition, you are going to hit him with an alimony award when you've actually made her column much greater than his column.
But the court has a lot of discretion on alimony. I mean, we know we don't have statutes on alimony setting up formulas like we do for child support. So, um, other than the source of where the alimony came from, how did the judge abuse his discretion in ordering the alimony?
The judge used his discretion by ordering his lump sum, Your Honor. That also seems to be problematic as well in this case, because if you look at 125.150 subsection 4, it talks about the court has the ability to give separate property to pay support, whether it's child support or alimony support, of the other party. The problem is, in this case, they don't have separate property like that, other than basic, like, separate property. All the property that they own are in those trusts. So,
well, that's separate property, isn't it? If then they create separate property trusts, wouldn't they each have separate property?
But all the property on the separate property trust were put in self-settled spendthrift trusts. So right. No longer does Mr. Nelson have any ownership in the corpus or principle of those trust properties. So that's the problematic nature of those two issues. So in addition, so along those lines,
you know, you indicated the problem here is the lump sum nature of the payment, correct?
Correct.
And my understanding of Williams versus Waldman is that the court may award alimony in a specified principal sum or a specified periodic payment as appears just and equitable. So is that conflict with your position? How do you reconcile that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat your question? I'm a little confused on how you're...
You indicated that the problem with the award, that it was a lump sum payment. And I'm saying under a particular case law, Williams versus Waldman, that seems to be contrary to your position that a lump sum payment can't be made.
Okay.
And I want to know how you can reconcile that if you can.
I don't dispute that a lump sum award can be made. The problem that I have with it is that, in this case, even Williams versus Waldman says it has to be just and equitable. The court missed those principles completely when you consider the other two. And then second of all on that issue, the lump sum, it talks about it coming from separate property. These parties don't own the property. So I don't see how...
Right. I just misunderstood you then, because I thought you indicated it, your problem was the fact that it was a lump sum payment.
No, my problem is twofold. First of all, there should be no alimony in this case. These parties both ended up with, and she actually ended up with more. If we're going to look on who, if either side, if we're going to say there has to be an alimony award, she ends up with $10 million, he ends up with, if we're saying it's theirs, which I still say that the trust law has to, but if she ends up with $10 million, he ends up with six when you reduce for those, the things that are in there with the values that are, you already heard from the trust, why would she be the one to get out? Like anybody, when you have a $10 million and $6 million, is going to be getting out, it should have gone the other way.
Right.
But when you look at the rest of it, we're
really
not arguing
just an equitable issue.
It's an equitable issue. It clearly misses the boat when you have a $10 million and $6 million, yet you order her alimony and you say how she got paid by her own trust to begin with, historically. That's the problem with the ruling from Judge Sullivan. In addition to those issues, there was a couple other side issues in the decree. There's a lot of issues in the decree, but to deal with in addition to alimony. So the other issues would be whether the court was divested of jurisdiction, because in that order that came in 2015 that the trust attorneys discussed, it also affects Mr. Nelson, because it says Eric Nelson and the ELN Trust will pay all these additional sums that it ruled on after it was divested of jurisdiction. So that is an issue for Mr. Nelson as well. Included in that. The other issue that we had before us for Mr. Nelson is that they ruled that he's an investment trust advisor. I mean, I had a hard time with that, because when I look at that, the decree talks a lot about a fiduciary duty, but it says he must disclose. By their own statement, she signed all the documents. So the transfer documents, they were brought to her. Her complaint is, well, he might get mad. Mr. Caraccioni said, well, he might get mad. Well, it's disclosure, so she still did that. She still signed them, and she had knowledge of all of them. So we disagree that that was part of the issue in the thing. Lastly, the liabilities. If we're going to say that some of these liabilities, there was a tax liability of over $100,000 that was not adjudicated because the judge took the position that no debts were, I don't have anything concrete, I'm not dealing with them. So we still have those issues that should have been dealt with before this case. Lastly, the unequitable issue that they did in this case, it's a small one, but it would be big for most people, is there are, the court's expert found that he paid $71,000 towards child expenses, but the court only gave him credit for $23,000, thinking that's fair. So that seems like it's very inequitable throughout the whole issue, especially when it came to, but most importantly, the divorce issue.
Do you concede the issue on Landreth versus Malik after hearing Mr. Carcione's arguments?
As far as the trust goes?
No, as far as the jurisdiction of the court. Mm-hmm.
As far as the jurisdiction of the alimony issue, the stuff that I was hired to represent, clearly Judge Sullivan had the jurisdiction to handle the issues for which I'm involved. I think the thing that I've read through all of the, because I had to read all those as well, is this. We expect the family court's exclusive jurisdiction to be respected. Why do we not expect the probate's exclusive jurisdiction to be respected? But I don't do probate law, so.
Okay.
So that would be it.
Just to, you know, we have three former chief judges, one from the second, two from the eighth in here. So.
Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. I thank counsel for their arguments. This matter will stand.